You're listening to the Wharton Alumni Executive Education Podcast.
Hello and welcome everyone to the Wharton Alumni Executive Education Podcast. I am your host, Alex Gromansky, and today I'm talking to Jonathan Anastas, who is CEO at Clash TV and Chairman of the Board at Alpha Metaverse Technologies. Thank you for being on today, and how are you doing?
Doing great. Thank you for having me. Excited to talk to the rest of the Wharton Executive Education Alumni Network.
Yeah, it's great to be able to have a chance to hear your story, because I'm looking at your LinkedIn profile here and it looks like you have a very interesting story, having been with One Esports, which is a notable company, and doing stuff in the metaverse, and now at Clash TV. It'd be great to, you know, hear a little about your history and what you've been doing and how you got to where you are.
Sure. Shoot questions away. I'm happy to answer them.
All right. So can you give us a little bit of a background as to, I guess, your career path and how you got to what you're doing at Clash TV right now?
Sure. So, you know, I think the great realization that everybody has about their own career is, I think very rarely is it the career you thought it was going to be, say, when you were in university. And, you know, we spend a lot of time on places like LinkedIn and resumes and in press trying to create this perfect linear path of a career, you know, that was all premeditated and planned, where we all know in reality that that very rarely happens, right? For most of us, we make either, you know, forced decisions or surprising decisions, and, you know, life hands you different options, and, you know, you always try to optimize them. So, you know, if I go way back, if you would ask me the first thing that I probably wanted to be when I was 16 or 17, my answer would have been rock star, right? And I spent some time pursuing a musical career and, you know, got a little bit of traction, but not the sort of traction that was going to create, you know, life-changing success or life-changing wealth. And, you know, the term pivot is very popular now, but made what I would call an early pivot at like age 20 to attend college when I didn't think I was going to attend college. I was just going to go, you know, be a musician. And I spent a couple of years after high school doing that full time. And probably the first thing that I was focused on, because it was, you know, I could see it from what I was doing, is I was going to go from being a musician to a music industry attorney. And so I, you know, went to university and I majored in political science. That's sort of, you know, the ideal pre-law. I had a minor in economics, which is probably the only indicator of, you know, sort of ending up doing business later. But, you know, that was probably my path. And right before graduation, I thought about, I can't remember if I had read an article potentially in Esquire or a magazine about that, about like sort of life in an ad agency. And they really painted this picture of like where creative people go to do business, right? That you could be a creative person and a creative soul and you could do business. And that spoke to me given where I was coming from as a creative person. And I thought, well, maybe I should try this out. And I decided I was going to spend a year working in an ad agency before I made, you know, the six-figure investment in law school. And I landed at one of the most creative ad agencies in America at the time, an agency, you know, based in Massachusetts, and absolutely fell in love with the business. And so I would say, you know, the first chapter in my career was advertising agencies and working with brands and, you know, sort of flexing, you know, my creative muscles at the same time that I was learning business muscles. And that arc of my career took me from Boston to New York City to Los Angeles and back to New York City. It took me from, you know, assistant media planner up to divisional president. And I very much enjoyed it. It kind of fit how my brain was wired. Again, I got to do business and do creative things. And then the great financial crisis hit in 2008, and I was laid off from my job, and I'm sitting here with a massive mortgage on an apartment in New York City. I still have my mortgage on a house in Los Angeles. I've got a tenant in my house in Los Angeles that isn't paying his rent, and I'm sure at this point I'm going to be destitute. I'm going to be homeless. You know, I'm going to lose both of these properties, and ad agencies are particularly sensitive to economic change. And I couldn't find a job in an ad agency. and sort of a top tier recruiting firm that I had a relationship with, I think it was Korn Ferry, put me in touch with a brand called Atari, you know, the legendary video game company, about global head of marketing. And I'd never worked on the brand side of marketing before, only on the agency side, but I'd worked in video games. And through this process, it turned out that the CEO, a guy named Jim Wilson, was an ex-client of mine from the video game industry when I worked on the agency side. And so we had a pre-existing relationship and thought highly of each other. And he was willing to give me a shot to sort of see, could this ad agency guy become a brand marketer? With the belief that I knew the video game space. If I didn't know how to be a brand marketer, at least I knew the business that they were in. And that launched the second chapter of my career. So I went chapter one, ad agency executive, creative person, chapter two, brand marketer. I went from Atari in New York. I then joined Activision, which was, you know, at the time, the largest video game publisher in the world. And it was kind of like going from playing, you know, all-star AAA baseball to going to the major leagues, you know, for a team like the New York Yankees or something. And I was first chief marketing officer of the Guitar Hero brand. And so now I'm kind of back in the music space, right? So now I'm like back to some other touchstones in my career. I'm working with artists and, you know, trying to, you know, it was a billion-dollar franchise, right? And try to grow a billion-dollar franchise. And working with artists like Metallica and Eminem and Jay-Z and Kiss and Guns N' Roses and Taylor Swift. And then they decided to shut down the Guitar Hero business unit and take a hiatus. I think we had launched 9 titles in 7 years, and there wasn't much money left to earn in that space. We kind of strip-mined it. And I became Activision's first global head of digital. And now I worked across all the franchises, including Call of Duty, which is, you know, I was there when that passed $10 billion in lifetime revenue. It's probably at $20 or $30 billion in lifetime revenue now. I helped launch Call of Duty in China with Tencent, sort of take a Western IP to the East for the first time. It was very interesting. And I had a great 5.5 year run there. And then I decided to do a couple of entrepreneurial things, still in the CMO sort of space, still as a brand marketer, early streaming. We built a streaming company out of the Motor Trend IP that we ended up selling to Warner Discovery in 2017. I kind of went even closer back to the music space as a CMO for a music streaming company called Live by Live that we took public on NASDAQ. And then in my last brand marketing role, landed, as you said, at One Championship and One Esports, which was a global MMA and esports organization, let's call it the UFC for the rest of the world, and was in the process of moving my family to Singapore in 2019, 2020. And then, of course, we had this global pandemic, right? You can never sort of predict what happens in life. And I remember sitting in my office in Singapore with my family behind in Los Angeles, my CEO coming into the room, and he's like, bro, you got to go home. And I was like, what do you mean I have to go home? And he's like, they're shutting down Los Angeles. And I was literally on the last flight on March 17th, 2020, back to LA before they shut down LA. And it was like landing in Blade Runner. Like, I wasn't even sure there'd be an Uber driver when I landed, you know, and I opened the Uber app to take me home. So I kind of went super OG and called a car service that I probably hadn't used in a decade, just so I knew that there was a person and a driver and somebody who would be there to pick me up and take me home to my family. And I worked some combination of remote and live in Singapore, and the US was one, until 2020, just based on whether America was open, whether Singapore was open. You know, we spent 5 months where we weren't doing any live events at all. And then we did some events in Thailand because they were the first company to open, the first country to reopen. And then we did a bunch of events in Singapore Indoor Stadium because Singapore was open. But it was a very different business. And also, it was interesting, you know, you could do things during COVID that you couldn't do in other times. And I had kind of explored, you know, doing something like executive education for a long time, and it just didn't fit in the traditional 70-hour work week and the traditional, you know, idea of, you know, I was probably traveling 10 days a month, every month, you know, in business for the last 15 or 20 years, and it just didn't fit. And all of a sudden in the world of COVID, it fit. And so I did you know, Wharton's Advanced Management Program. I did AMP 81, and I picked a hybrid model where I was alternatively for 15 months or whatever it was, spending 5 days a month on Zoom from Los Angeles, and alternating where I was spending 5 days a month on campus, you know, in Philadelphia. And I was really happy I picked the hybrid program as opposed to the all remote program. I got a lot of relationship building and knowledge out of being in person on campus in a way that I don't think of if I could have in all hybrid. But once again, it was the thing that I couldn't have planned for. It never would have been possible, you know, in a world where, like, you know, as long as I'm willing to be up at 3 a.m, I can take meetings from, you know, the Wharton campus in my room to my day job. And, you know, or be on Zoom for 6 hours of the day in Los Angeles. And it was an incredible opportunity. And I sort of made that choice because I decided, you know, if the second chapter of my life was brand marketing, I really wanted to take a shot at being an operator and being a P&L owner after doing some entrepreneurial things, you know, after these two arcs. And so here you are finding me at the beginning of what I call the third arc of my career as, you know, startup CEO, trying to borrow from all the other pieces of my career. And, you know, I live at the intersection of sports and streaming and culture. And if you think about, like, what Gen Y and Gen Z, particularly dudes, are doing, their internet experience is sports and music and gaming and esports. And their culture is built around that. And so I sort of feel like it's the building blocks from all of my career, you know, sort of Fortune 500, startup, you know, gaming, music, esports, sports, all brought together. I'm trying to use muscles and knowledge from every piece of my career here.
What I love about that story is that you wanted to be, so to speak, a rock star when you started out at the beginning. Then you get to work on Guitar Hero, be a totally different kind of rock star, rocking with some of the world's legends. So that's a really cool path to get to that same place. And what was that like for you to be able to work alongside some of those people? I want to touch on that a little bit.
Well, I mean, it was interesting, right? Because I would like to say that I had some empathy for, you know, how they approach something, which was different than a business person. But, you know, they had all achieved it at a level that I had never achieved it. I mean, it had some sort of personal fandom moments, you know, like it was, we launched the last Guitar Hero I worked on before we took a break with a big giant party in an airplane hangar at the Santa Monica Airport with Metallica playing. And, you know, sort of they had flown down from San Francisco on Activision's private jet. You know, at the peak of it all, I'm launching this Guitar Hero game with a party in an airplane hangar in Santa Monica with Metallica headlining. We sort of flew them down on Activision's corporate jet from San Francisco. And to talk about your full circle, you know, a number of years earlier, I had opened for Metallica, you know, in club shows. So, you know, it was really interesting to sort of like touch this business from the other side, right? Or, you know, we'd hire like Kanye to play a show. And to sort of, you know, even negotiating the contracts and negotiating the deals, it, you know, it was interesting because I had some knowledge from the other side. So it was great. It was a way to put all my passions together. And again, I'd like to think that what I brought to the table was being able to bridge those two worlds, which actually kind of goes back to one of the first things I did out of college. Like, I was working in an ad agency on the Timberland account. And Timberland had this idea, this sort of give back campaign. So imagine it's the 90s and Timberland is like, you know, the hottest thing in urban America to the point where like people are getting robbed for their Timberlands. And the CEO of Timberland decides he wants to do this give racism the boot campaign. So literally the campaign was the, you know, the iconic Timberland boot, right? And so the image was the Timberland boot and it literally the copy wrapped was give racism the boot, and this ran, you know, on like bus shelters and billboards, you know, all over urban America. And we did this deal with Def Jam Records, and I got sent off as a super junior person, way more junior than they normally would have done, because nobody really knows how to interact with these people, right? And it's like, well, send the tattooed guy who used to be a musician down to New York to talk to these guys, right? It was kind of that, right? It was like, well, I guess he's the person who has the most in common. So, you know, I sort of got sent way out over my skis to go down to New York City very early in my career and meet with, you know, Russell Simmons and Lior Cohen about, you know, bringing their artists into this whole Give Racism the Boot campaign. So, yeah, so I think your life experiences, you know, things that you don't necessarily see the value in at the time become valuable later.
Yeah, what an incredible story. And on the Guitar Hero, my wife was a huge Guitar Hero fan, skipped way too many days of school, she tells me, playing Guitar Hero. So what an incredible franchise that you guys built out there. So that's really cool on that side. And then starting your Arc 3, your founder journey, what is it that you do with Clash TV now?
So as the CEO, I sort of see, I mean, A, this is kind of like a 0-1 startup. So I think, you know, being a startup CEO, very different than being a Fortune, you know, 500 CEO. When you're Fortune 500 CEO, and what I really learned, you know, from people like Bobby Kotick is, you know, how to best deploy capital. You know, like I remember having those old conversations where we think we'd have this great idea and he'd basically be like, if it doesn't shed, you know, $500 million in EBITDA, it's not worth getting out of bed for, right? Like that's a waste of capital, right? Like only put capital to work, you know, where you can really make a meaningful, you know, impact from shareholder value. In terms of managing the expectation around that shareholder value, you know, I think we over-delivered, you know, against estimate for every one of the quarters that I was there. And I could see how the company put a lot of focus into, you know, exceeding expectation and, you know, managing analysts and managing the market's expectation and always over delivering. And then you're always hiring, you know, you're always hiring around succession planning, gaps in talent, you know, 3-year plans, 5-year plans. I learned all that stuff. There'll be a time when a lot of that stuff is applicable to Clash TV. You know, at this level, it's a lot more around, you know, I work in quarterly goals and 1-year stretch goals as opposed to 3-year plans and 5-year plans, right? The world is going to change radically in 6 months. You know, I've gone from, you know, managing, you know, reforecasting quarterly to I have monthly board meetings with cash flow, right? Because it's early stage startup. So I'm doing 12 board meetings a year, you know, not 4 board meetings a year. And there's much more of like a player coach component. Right. You know, I'm much more in the details of things than I was even as a vice president or an SVP or even a senior director, you know, at some of these larger companies I worked at. And I think, you know, if we have the success we want, the interesting piece of it all is going to be like when you start migrating out of having your hands in everything into like heading towards that other place. Right. Because at some point, and I was having this conversation with my board in the last board meeting, it becomes an hourglass, right? If I have to touch everything, I become the pinch point in the middle of the hourglass. At some point, my hands on everything accelerates things. And then after a certain point, my hands in everything decelerates things because I become the pinch point, right? So to the degree that my hands can push, I'm an accelerant. And then at some point, we're trying to do so much volume that the squeeze, you know, there's less sand getting through, right? And less things get done and I become a hindrance. And we're sort of talking through that point and right. And if my hands are on things that I don't think they should be on, do we have a talent problem, right? Do we have a communication problem? Are my hands on things they shouldn't be on because we have got the wrong person in that job? Are my hands on things that they shouldn't be on because we haven't communicated clearly what our expectations are? And balancing that hands-on, hands-off, I think, is a key piece of kind of like 0-1 as a CEO. But ultimately, I have to keep everybody focused on where we're going with this understanding that we're not looking 3 and 5 years out, right? We're looking 3 and 6 months out. You know, from a cash flow perspective, as we're raising money, I'm trying to manage against 12 to 18 month burns. But from a literal like OKR KPI perspective, I've got like, you know, 90 to 180 day KPIs on people because what we're doing in 180 days might be very different than what we're doing now.
And what made you want to start Clash TV and what is Clash TV?
Well, to be clear, I did not start.
Oh, okay. You did not start. Okay.
I'm not the founder. So I was brought in as the first outside CEO to Clash TV. They felt they were sort of at an inflection point where it was time for the founders to take, you know, more board seat, board chair, visionary, you know, 50,000 foot, where should we be going roles, and to bring in, you know, somebody with some more operational experience in the space. You know, well, one championship was certainly not Activision, right? You know, and $8 billion a year, you know, revenue company that sold for $70 billion, biggest transaction in the history of video gaming. Never bet against Bobby Kotick. That's what I've always told people. One championship, you know, was 300 people, raised, you know, $500 million in venture capital, 250 of it while I was there, but still had this very like every day is day one mentality. And so they wanted somebody who had, you know, who had sort of seen how to take something somewhere, but, you know, was still hungry enough that they weren't afraid to be hands-on, right? If they're trying to like, you know, get a experienced Fortune 500 CEO, they don't want to go back to being a player coach necessarily, yeah. Right? They want to go back into like monthly budget reforecasts. And, you know, as I said, I'd done some more entrepreneurial things that were earlier stage. We talk about Alpha. I came in as a board member in 2020. We took the company public in 2021 on the CSE. We made a couple of tuck-in acquisitions. We raised a couple of pipes. You know, that was more entrepreneurial. And it's obviously even very different to be the board chair on an early stage company. You know, I lead Alpha through questioning, right? Like my role in a board chair is like, you know, I look at the operational plan. I ask questions, maybe I ask leading questions, I have ideas, I have postulates, but it's the management's job, it's the CEO and the CFO's job to run the company, right? I'm trying to guide, I'm trying to bring from my experience, but, you know, I'm not the player coach, I don't have my hands in there, you know, I'm sort of looking and sort of saying like, well, why are we increasing headcount at a time when margin's declining? Isn't that counterintuitive, right? Is if margins dip to X, I want to see OPEX fall. Right? Why have you not cut OPEX? As opposed to being the person who has to come in there and cut OPEX, right? So, you know, I think they wanted somebody who balanced hungry and understanding early stage, but also the discipline of sort of where we could go. You know, we're going through 2024 planning now. And, you know, I introduced the concept of we've got to do a tops down and a bottoms up. And I think we were getting really hung up in this bottoms up planning and we were getting stuck. And I thought about what did we do at Activision, right? There was always a top-down plan. And then we, you know, cross-referenced the top-down, the top-up plan, you know, from bottoms-up plan. And so, you know, I was like, all right, so I'm going to do a quick, you know, top-down and let's reconcile against the bottoms-up and try to figure out how to get there, right? So I think it's that sort of like, you know, level of, you know, I've seen the other side of the mountain, but I'm still hungry enough, which is what they thought I could bring to the table.
Well, and you're also able to articulate what you're trying to bring across and where the differences are.
Yes, on a good day, I'm trying to articulate. on a bad day, I'm trying not to be too frustrated, right? Because I think the other thing, and I've talked to some, you know, some other founders about this, like in an early stage company, belief is everything. And belief comes in two things. A, every person has to understand what you're trying to do every day to drive the ball forward. And if everybody doesn't understand what the goals are, you've done a poor job as management. But the other thing is like, early stage companies are hyper sensitive to negativity, to, you know, tough corporate culture. I think especially today, like I think I learned a lot of great muscle memory at Activision. I think one of the bad muscle memories I learned is it was a very sharp elbows culture with a super high expectation. And what I sort of realized is like potentially I was bringing too much of that to Clash even, right? And I was like, oh, I get it. I need to be sort of motivational. I need to be more positive. I need to swallow my frustration, right? Not swallowing my frustration is my flaw, right? Is my mistake. It's how I think I'm trying to push the company ahead, but it's how I'm you know, holding it back. So, you know, we're all learning all the time and trying to improve.
Would you say that there's times where, you know, being harder on people versus being motivational is beneficial, or what's your experience been? Why did that work for Activision and maybe doesn't work in that startup world?
You know, I think every company has a culture. I think there's some people that would say that it didn't work at Activision. I mean, their financial success was undeniable, but I also think it's generational. Like, it's funny. I'm Gen X. I grew up in a recession. I grew up, you know, with a boss who told me every day that I was lucky to have a job, and there was 100 people waiting to have for my job if I wasn't there. You know, I grew up in a culture where, like, you know, it's that old joke about Disney where somebody, you know, somebody would come in, your boss would touch the hood of your car when they got in there to see if it was still warm. How long had you been there? You know, the old Disney, like, if you don't come in on Saturday, don't bother to come in on Sunday. Like, the first place I worked at, there was no assigned parking. And the prescribed culture was that you park in order you arrived, from the closest to the front door to the farthest, right? But there was no assigned parking. The CEO was often the first person there and was the closest parking spot to the front door. But if you got there earlier than they did, you could have that first spot, right? There's no, you know, name, there's no anything. And I prided myself on being like the third car most days, right? And I had a boss who, you know, never said anything, but would look at the card key entries every day. What time did everybody come in? What time did everybody leave? Right. And I also learned early in my career, I was like, I'd come in like third. There was a bathroom across from the CEO's office. It was not the closest bathroom to my office. I used to use that bathroom at 7:15 every morning so he could see that I was in the office at 7:15 every morning. And I'll tell you, it's 2 or 3 days a week that turned into, hey, Jonathan, come in here. You know, let's sit down and talk. What are you up to? What are you doing? And I argued I had 45 minutes a week with the CEO of a company that the person who did not come in at 7:15 never got, right? That's the positive reinforcement. The negative reinforcement is, I remember the first time one of my supervisor's father had, his family had a baby. And I remember, you know, like, advertising agencies, weird hours, client problems late at night. Like, my boss's boss would come down the hall. Where's, I won't use their name, but where's so-and-so? Pretend this person's name was Jeff. Where's Jeff? Oh, Jeff went home. Jeff went home to put his daughter to bed. Oh, we got a client problem. Can you fix it? Of course, I'm there. I fix it, right? Out of ambition, and also I'm the only person there. After about the fourth time that happened, there was no more Jeff, right? And so for positive or negative reasons, that got burned in my head, right? And also by the time I became a father, it, believe me, that was a huge problem in my head. Like, when I first became a dad, I was like, I can't be Jeff. Right. I can't be the person who's not there the fourth time somebody comes to solve a problem and I'm gone, either for better or for worse. And so I think there's a generation of us that grew up with that level of motivation. I think Gen Z doesn't operate in that sort of fear driven, you know, career first. And I think one of the things that I have to adjust to as a Gen X executive is try to figure out what are the motivational positive or negative tools that worked on me and for me aren't necessarily going to work today. And I think, you know, one of the greatest examples I heard of that recently is I was having breakfast with a colleague who went off to be president of a company that had a large number of Gen Z employees. It was in the video game space. And he was talking about reducing corporate travel. He's like, you know, it's one of these companies where corporate travel is very outsized relative to the size of the company. It was kind of egalitarian. You know, no matter who you were in the company, if it was more than 2 hours or whatever, you could fly first class. Like, it didn't matter. We were burning a huge amount of money on travel. I went in and I tried to talk about it in terms of P&L and shareholder value. And I tried to be transparent. I had these whole lists of, you know, who spent what on travel in the company by name. And he was like, I was always number one. Like, I was calling myself out too. Like, my name was always at the top and it was getting nowhere. It wasn't changing. And we ended up reframing it around carbon footprint. And we ended up reframing the whole travel conversation around cause and saying, we as a company are trying to reduce our carbon footprint. Travel is the number one negative application of carbon footprint in this company. If we want to improve our carbon footprint, we need to travel less. All of a sudden, all that work that got no response got great response. He's like, it got such great response, I couldn't get people to travel when they were supposed to travel. That all of a sudden people are like, ooh, really? Do I have to go to London? My carbon footprint. And he was saying, like, with a largely Gen Z, you know, employee base, trying to solve the same problem around profit went nowhere, reframed the exact same problem around cause, and solve the problem.
So that blows my mind. First of all, that you guys found a different way to solve the same problem, or that you would even consider that framing.
His excellence, not mine. His story, not mine. I'm just listening to the story. But yes.
Yeah. But wow, is what goes through my head on that side. Would you then say a lot of this has to do with supply and demand? You used to say then there was 100 people that would be willing to take your job or have your job, at least according to your manager. Nowadays, I think people can quit and find a new job somewhere else. So employers are trying to hold on to employees. Is this a supply and demand question, or do you think there's something else going on there? Or is the new generation just that talented that they don't have to work?
Well, here's what I would say. I would say you always want to hold on to your best talent. Retention of your best talent should always be top of mind for management, right? You want your top 10%, 20%, whatever you want to define it as, performers to never leave. And the motivation for the top 20% of Gen X might be very different than the motivation for the top 20% of Gen Z, right? Like, you know, one group might be like title, responsibility, money, compensation. The other one might be work-life balance, you know, whatever. So I think there's a core, which is like keeping your best talent never changes. The only thing that changes is what keeps your best talent, right? I think the second piece is I've lived through upsides and downsides that there's a constant redefinition of who has hand, who has power between the employer and the employee, right? Like, you know, we started this conversation talking about my desperate need to find a job in 2008. And it should probably not surprise you or any listener to say that my starting salary and my new job in 2009 was lower than my last salary when I got hired in 2007 at the height of the boom, right? I was happy to take 20% less money or whatever, right? It all re-equivalizes, right? You get to like, things get frothy again, you get to earn that money back. Like, who has hand always changes. Right. You know, like, you know, who, whether it's the, you know, management or the employee, always the balance of power is always changing and always shifting. And, you know, even now in certain industries, like you remember, you know, when we were creating 500,000-600,000 jobs a month and, you know, Netflix couldn't hire people fast enough. Nobody went back to the office because nobody had to go back to the office. Right. Then tech starts doing layoffs. And then somebody breaks and now everybody I know is going back to the office, you know, two times a week or three times a week. And everybody that I know pretty much is just waiting for the first couple people to break to 5 days a week. You know, I was talking to the CEO of an ad agency and he's like, I insist on 3 days a week because that's what everybody else insists on. So if somebody's unhappy coming to work at my agency 3 days a week, they can't quit and go someplace else where it's not 3 days a week because everybody that I care about, everybody I compete with is 3 days a week. Right. If I went to five, my competitors aren't at five and I might lose talent. As soon as somebody goes to five, everybody's going to go to five. Right. So there's always this push pull. And I also think to go back to top talent is going to always get to define their role. Right. Like the average employee may be forced back to 5 days a week, but the top performer may be able to insist on 1 day a week. Right. That's just the way it is.
The top performer is probably already showing up 5 days a week.
Well, I mean, that's the generational thing. My generational thing. I remember reading some quote. This is non-quantitative, but it's like your best employees are already at 5 days a week. They self-selected 5 days a week to your point. Right. But that may or may not be true, but you know, it's funny. So again, I always think there's a balance of power and I'm, you know, and so without being cruel about it or unfair, I'm always trying to think about like, you know, are we in a balance of position where I have more power versus, you know, the other side of the equation in any negotiation. Like you want to go into any negotiation with some sort of realism about where you sit at the table, right? You can postulate anytime you want. Like I don't want to say the organization, but we've re-entered one of the organizations I work with. We re-entered a negotiation for something that stalled, you know, a number of months ago because the balance of power in that negotiation has shifted. It's ongoing, so I don't want to say anything more than that, but it was like the position of the two parties has changed from 60 days ago because the relative position of power in that negotiation has changed. And we are realistic enough to understand that.
So you seem to have a very good grasp on the human experience, the human relationship side of things. And what do you think though, from a tactical or practical or technical standpoint, did you do right or were you getting right other than hard work and showing up and putting in the hours and that led you to be successful as a creative, whether it was Activision or with Motor Trend or what you're doing with right now or with eSport that has helped you in your career growth?
Well, first I want to say I've done things terribly wrong. I've made every mistake you could possibly make, I am sure. Many times, right? And I think I've made terrible business decisions in my career. I've made, you know, terrible, you know, sort of like relationship leverages experiences in my career. I pressed too hard and thought I had more leverage than I had, you know. So, you know, I think my career far from perfect. And I think, again, when you go back to LinkedIn or resume, everyone's trying to build this, you know, chart on their career that, you know, looks like, you know, the best growth chart from like a fundraise in 2019, where they're all up and to the right. And the truth is, all of our careers are squiggly, right? When you squint, they should go up and to the right. And maybe on a good day, when you look at my resume or my LinkedIn, when you squint, it goes up to the right. But, you know, I was the guy who was sitting jobless in, you know, 2008 with two mortgages thinking I was going to be homeless. Or like, I'm the person whose company ended up getting shut down during .com 1.0. Or like, you know, my employment contract didn't get renewed there. So again, I want to go into this thing. I've sort of made every mistake that you could possibly make. The thing that I think, honestly, I'd attribute, if nothing else, survival to, is like grit and never stop showing up. Like, you just kind of can't knock me down. And if you go back to like the best baseball players bat 300, which means, you know, 7 out of 10 times the best baseball players in the world fail, in essence, fail, and with quotation marks, they don't get on base. You got to get to bat a lot, right? So like, my thing is like, I want as many at bats as I can get. And that's meant literally having two jobs at once. That's meant, you know, having two roles in the same organization. Like, when Activision brought back Guitar Hero, I literally had two business cards for the same company, where I was like the co-GM of the new Guitar Hero and still the global head of digital, right? Twice as many meetings, you know. I've always been willing to take on advisory boards and board seats. So I literally would say the number one ascriber to whatever I've achieved is just like never giving up and just being willing to work harder and work more. And like, if you knock me down today, I'm gonna come back tomorrow. And again, I just don't think you can even account for how powerful just as many at bats as you could possibly get are. Because even when you strike out or you bunt or you learn something, like, and I've learned something at every failure. So I really think that's been my superpower, right? My superpower has been the inability to give up and the desire to take as many bats as possible. And I think everybody should do that. You know, I think one of the things that I could have done better is there's been times where I was sort of afraid the next thing wasn't going to happen and sort of took the first thing that was offered when I probably could have held out for a better thing. But the fear of like, I don't take this thing, nothing else is going to come. Which is also tied to this potential that, like, maybe I didn't think through enough. Like, I kind of thought, like, part of taking as many bats is, like, I can make anything work. I can succeed at anything. And that is not true. Nobody can make anything work. Nobody can succeed at everything. Nobody can succeed at anything. There are unwinnable positions. I've learned something in my positions I've lost in. But there's no such thing as you can win at anything. And I probably should have learned that earlier. But again, it's just trying to navigate this, you know, this sort of human side with the, you know, this quantitative with the qualitative, the creative with the data. You know, I think like everybody has to be a little bit of a multi-hyphenate these days. Like, you have to understand the big idea and you have to understand the numbers. The people that just understand the big idea tend to fail at operations, and they never built the right foundation, and the building collapses because the foundation is weak, right? And I think the other side, if you just think about the bottom line too much, your building never gets tall enough, right? So you're trying to manage, like, I don't want to build this super tall building with a horrible foundation, and I don't want to overthink the foundation so much that I never get up to 30 stories, if that makes sense. No. And I've been trying to, like, balance those two.
So then how do you decide where you would now take on opportunities or where you take on advisory or board roles? Because, you know, metaverse is new and growing and maybe exciting, and maybe that's why creative for you. But how did you decide to get involved in the metaverse? And then how did you decide to become CEO of Clash TV?
Well, it's interesting. When I first got involved in Alpha, it was Alpha Esports. That was the first iteration of the company. And I got involved because, you know, I had a long-time passion and experience in the gaming. And we ended up sort of pivoting into metaverse because that's where gaming came together. you know, I would say this, the one professional constant in my career that I think is my differentiator is my career has been built around managing disruption and managing through disruption, specifically digital disruption. And what I mean by that is I was one of the first advertising agency executives to choose digital over, you know, like I shot my fair share of sexy television commercials. And at some point I chose what appeared to be at the time, the less sexy path and to go to digital marketing. And my friends would be flying around the world making TV commercials and they'd roll their eyes that I was making websites and early social media profiles. And 5 years later, they didn't have a job and they didn't have the skill set in the new stuff to pivot to digital, right? And then I came to gaming at a time when I got to Atari and even early Activision, gaming was defined by how many shrink wrap boxes could you sell off a shelf, right? It was a packaged goods business. You know, and most of the executives that had succeeded at Activision came from places like Pepsi and Procter & Gamble. And by the time I left Activision, it was thought of as an ARPU business, right? And it was digitally distributed. You know, half of the games are now sold, not in shrink wrap boxes. And we weren't looking at number of units sold, but we were looking at like MAUs, DAUs, ARPU, lifetime value, thinking about it like a digital business. And we were hiring more people from Google, from Meta, right? It, you know, from Amazon, it became an entirely different business. I kind of managed Motorken through from magazines to an SVOD service. When I landed at One in 2019, most of our media rights deals were linear television. COVID happens, that accelerates the change to streaming. You know, sports actually had been sort of like the laggard in the space, where, you know, movies and TV shows were already largely streamed by the time I joined One. Like Netflix was huge, but like the NFL was all on linear TV, right? The NBA was all on linear TV. MLB was all on linear TV. And by the time I left One in 2022, AAA sports had largely migrated to streaming, right? So this idea of like kind of managing through digital disruption and leading through digital disruption is a muscle memory that I've really built. And so even in sort of thinking through how gaming becomes the metaverse and how the metaverse is going back to gaming, right? Like this week was the big, the week we're recording this, there's a big talk about, you know, launching like the Lego metaverse inside a video game, right? It's like gaming and metaverses are coming together. So, you know, that's the constant in my career, right? How to find profit and audience and engagement inside digital disruption.
And in your experience, would you say their audience demand has always just been slow or early? Or, you know, why do some companies like, let's say, Facebook, that even rebrand to Meta, then I think end up giving up on Metaverse, I think, and then other companies continue down the path?
I mean, I don't want to like call the shot on the Metaverse yet. You know, I think like a lot of things, markets are imperfect. I think markets are rarely in exact equilibrium. They're either ahead of themselves or behind themselves. And I think with crypto, we got ahead of ourselves. And then, you know, we're arguably, then potentially we got behind ourselves, right? That like, you know, Bitcoin has doubled in the last year, right? So Bitcoin's not 65 like it used to be, but it's also not 18 anymore, right? And, you know, I think about esports. You know, FaZe Clan went public at a $700 million valuation, likely ahead of itself. It sold last month for $15 million. I argue that assets ultimately might be worth more than $15 million someday. So I think, you know, companies are always trying to figure out, you know, do you want to be first to something? Do you want to be second to something? Very rarely does the true innovator end up winning. Right? Like the iPhone was not the first smartphone. I make Tesla bulls very angry because I often say that I believe, well, Elon Musk gets an incredible amount of credit. I'm driving a non-Tesla electric car because of Tesla. The maker that makes my car would not have made it if it was not for Tesla. I ultimately think Tesla might be BlackBerry, that like down the road, the great bull. I mean, already Tesla used to have 95% market share. Now it's got 45% market share. You go to China, it has less than that. So like markets are never in equilibrium. Like should Tesla be worth more than every automotive company in the world combined? likely not. And I think companies are just trying to figure out where they want to fall on that curve, right? And, you know, when I was in automotive working on digital early, they had so much money that they could peel off what seemed like a really large investment to get ahead of the curve, right? And if you're Meta, you peeled off a couple billion dollars to invest in the metaverse, but it ultimately wasn't, you know, really negative on your earnings necessarily, right? It was kind of a rounding error on your earnings, right? Like we still don't know what Apple TV does for Apple, right? But it's the $2 trillion company. Do we care? Does it keep Tim Cook awake at night, right? If their headsets fail, right? You know, like probably not.
Yeah, no, fair enough. I was just trying to get your take on how you kind of make decisions and where you see things, because you've seemed to have a knack for it.
Well, here's what I would say, right? If I was, it's interesting, right? Because you make different choices. Like I go back to when I was at Activision, we were considered by Wall Street behind on mobile games, right? So at some point, call it 2012, 2013, the stock was starting to get punished, right? Think of when Zynga was at the height of its valuation, right? And Wall Street was like, you got to go buy Zynga, you got to buy Zynga. And Bobby just couldn't wrap his head around the fact that at that point, Zynga was valued equivalent to Activision with nowhere near the EBITDA, you know, losing money. And ultimately, Bobby's decision was not to act when the street was pushing him to act, but Bobby's decision was based on acting when he found the right opportunity, and he found the right opportunity in King. It was a broken IPO. I think it was selling for like $2 a share less than the IPO price. And so he scooped up a relative bargain that was a cash machine that ultimately was hugely accretive to market cap, hugely accretive to value, but he waited for the right moment and the right deal, right? Like he didn't just say, oh, Wall Street's pushing me, I better go buy Zynga, and I'm happy to overpay for Zynga, right? I think the mistake is when you see this world that like if somebody puts a significant amount of capital, and this is why I said it's sort of that level, like how to best use capital is one of the biggest jobs of a CEO, right? Like I'm just going to go overpay for something and hope that it works, right? And I think that's the mistake you need not to make, right? Is, you know, again, if you're such a big company that you're just making rounding error choices, in my day-to-day Clash TV, I don't have that luxury, right? I don't have that capital. I don't have access to that capital. I don't have that marketplace value. I don't have that market cap where I could go do it. So I have to think much more like, you know, I think startups grow in kind of like, they don't grow in a linear fashion. You stall, you find an unlock. You stall, you find an unlock, right? So I'm always trying to say, where can that capital, human and otherwise, be best approved, you know, best applied to find the next unlock? Like what's, if I have a limited amount of capital, what's going to move the growth curve the fastest, right? That's how I'm making decisions, right? What's the thing, whether it's a marketing beat, whether it's a content investment, whether it's a product feature, like which investments are going to give me disproportionate return? That's honestly how I'm looking to apply human capital and capital at this point and growth trajectory.
Yeah, which means you're also always looking for opportunities and never essentially shutting down opportunities, because you have to see where do you have places to put capital in order to then go and get those disproportionate returns, because other people might not be focusing on those areas.
That is absolutely true. And I have to count on like smarter fiscal partners than I in this stuff. Like I know what I don't know, you know, like 15 months of AMP is not going to turn a person who is like a marketer and, you know, a generalist business person into like a finance expert. Right. So I'm always looking to have these decisions informed by people who are incredible subject matter experts, right? Whether that's a head of product who's going to tell me whether that thing I'm being pitched is bullshit or not, or real, right? Is the code good or not? Or a great CFO who's helping me understand like what Kager can do. You know, like, again, I've tried to improve my own blind spots. Like, you know, Wharton and AMP was a continuation of, I remember when I landed at Activision and it was a publicly traded company, and I was a marketer. I was like, and finance held such sway in like green light meetings that I ended up going to the Anderson School at UCLA and just taking corporate finance 1 and 2 as like a continuing ed student, because I just needed the vocabulary in the room. Right. And again, like, so I talk about grit and stuff. Like, I think like one of my unlocks was like, most of my marketing colleagues did not do it and kept talking like marketers in the room. And I went and took corporate finance 1 and 2. And all of a sudden the finance guys are like, hey, I'm going to go listen to this guy a little bit more because I can speak in their language now. And those terms that they're using that are glossing, that I could just see some of my marketing colleagues gloss over, like, oh my God, they said some word, I don't know what it is, I can actually have a response to, right?
So it's interesting that a creative person can take finance courses. What does a finance person do to get creative?
I actually have met some unbelievably creative finance people, right? And by the way, I think smart finance is creativity, right? Like I think you can manipulate numbers in unbelievably creative ways. But I don't mean like, we're not talking about like, you know, fraudulent stuff, but I mean, like, I remember the first agency I worked at, the CEO at the annual meeting used to talk about what the CFO did at that company with payables, receivables, free cash. And he's like, it added like 3 points of, you know, margin or whatever it added, right? And he used to talk about him as a creative person to the creative people, being like, do you know that Paul Slack added 4 points of margin due to his creativity as the CFO? Like, he used to speak in those terms, right? So I was sort of couched in those terms. And I think, you know, incredible CFOs understand implicitly the underlying businesses that they're in. And I would like to believe that most of them who've chosen to work in creative businesses, work in creative businesses as opposed to non-creative businesses, because the creativity of those businesses speaks to them and inspires them, you know. And I don't think it's a surprise, like, you know, if a CFO moves from Activision to Netflix, as opposed from like Activision to, you know, I don't know, something that would arguably seem less creative on the surface, you know?
Yeah. Oh, fair enough. Well, I appreciate all your time today. It's been a really great conversation. Loved hearing your story. You've shed a lot of wisdom, so thank you for doing that as well.
Thanks for having me. I just love sharing it. You know, like, what I would say is I learned so much of my time at Wharton, not just from the professors at the course load, but from my classmates and their broad range of experiences. And I also think, like, as you try to build and stretch in your careers, like, I'm in this early stage, you know, CEO and an operator inside my first year, that like the more I can learn from people, the better that I do. Like, I've got my group of mentors who, you know, span decades, you know. Like, I, you know, one of my strongest mentors at this point is like the retired ex CFO of Warner Music, right? Some guy who's been retired for a number of years, but he has all this business wealth. So what I'm just trying to do in all this is like pay back what I've learned from people. And if anything in my journey can help people, I'm happy to share it. And especially in a group of alumni, I have a place that's, you know, for a 15-month program, you know, sort of levered up what I think that I'm capable of. If nothing else, I came out of AMP thinking and believing that I was capable of being a CEO, which I wasn't necessarily sure of when I went into AMP. So if anything I can give back to that group, I'm game for. So thank you for having me.
I love it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.